This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. It's considered the largest Native American museum in the world, and it's right here in Connecticut. Coming up, we'll take you on an audio tour of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center in Southeast Connecticut. The museum is tribally owned and operated, and next year marks its 20th anniversary. Now, have you been to the museum? What did you learn about the Pequot people that you did not learn in school? Where do we begin? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266, email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, on the phone with me now is Jason Mancini. He's director of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me on.
It's quite an impressive museum. We took a tour the other week, and coming up again, our listeners will hear part of that tour. But talk through with us the mission of the museum, Jason, since it was created and how it's been changing.
Yeah, so the museum was created with the notion to improve our understanding of the richness and diversity of Native cultures of North America. And it was a pretty expansive mission. And we've had to adapt it over time. We focus a lot on the content of our exhibits, which are focused principally on northeastern North America. And certainly the Mashantucket Pequot tribe and the tribal communities of this region. Over the last few years, since I've taken over the role of director, I wanted to work collaboratively with my team here to really expand the idea of education through the museum's various components. So not just the exhibits, but bringing education through food, through arts and crafts, and through public programming.
I mentioned that next year is the 20th anniversary of the museum. So back when it opened in 1998, walk us through when that opened. I know you've only been the director the last 3 years, but when they were looking at let's build this museum, and it's not just a small museum. I mean, it's over 300,000 square feet. There's very specific permanent exhibits, including these extensive dioramas, this Pequot village we'll hear about a little bit later. But just the idea behind the museum and why they felt it was important.
Well, I think, indigenous histories in this nation are often overwritten by colonial histories and marginalized. And the tribe had some success with Foxwoods Casino at the time, and what was originally conceived as a smaller museum quickly took on a new shape with the possibilities through revenues generated by Foxwoods. And the tribe really had engaged early on historical research and archaeological work on the reservation to tell a more thorough story, their story, from their perspective, and working with university scholars, elders, and a range of other professionals to really in a very deep and complex way, retell the Pequot narrative. And so not just the contemporary narrative, but there's 12,000 years of human occupation of this region, and to really begin regrounding that narrative in an indigenous perspective.
Now, Jason, what about your background that led you to this museum, and what did you know about the Pequot people growing up?
Well, so I actually grew up in Ledyard, Connecticut, which is where the tribe's reservation is, Mashantucket. It's in the northeast corner of town. And I went to school with Pequot kids when I was a kid, and at the same time, learning about local history and national history, and that Pequots didn't exist. At the same time, I was sitting next to Pequot students in the classroom. So, and at the same time, in the mid-1980s, my uncle had a close working relationship with the tribal chairman at the time, and began to do a very long-term archaeological project on the reservation. So I became involved back then in the mid-1980s because of my own interest in archaeology and my uncle's support of that passion. So I started my work at the museum back in the early 1990s in the research department, focused on historical records and archaeological work. So that continued for a good 20 years anyway.
I understand one of the projects that the museum is involved in, along with UConn, is understanding more about the battlefields of the Pequot War. Can you talk about that project?
Yeah. So the Pequot War is one of the most significant events in early American history, and yet it remains very elusive in the national narrative of this country. The conflict between the English and the Pequots is really sort of ground zero for it's really the center of the relationship and grounds Indian policy in this nation. And it's often been told for 400 years through the English colonial lens. And the archaeological work and the battlefield protection projects that we're working on through the National Park Service have really elucidated what this conflict was about, the impacts of it. Its memory and legacy is told through various local histories and oral histories, and it's a deeply impactful conflict that we're able to give new shape to through an interdisciplinary approach through our research team.
And that's a big part of the mission, too. So you're not just walking through and seeing exhibits related to the history. You have researchers coming to your facility to do that work as well. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jason?
Absolutely. So the archaeological work is one component. We work collaboratively with a range of archaeologists from around the region who've come here, studied sites at Mashantucket. We've identified around 300 sites that span 12,000 years here. But more than that, we've done tremendous historical research that focus on the tribe and the tribes of this region. And because of that marginalized history, we've been able to really root through a range of resources from historical societies, personal archives, national archives, going as far away as Europe. We found archives on Pequot people and Native people from southern New England and Hawaii and in Alaska and New Zealand. The folks here were not these sort of marginalized backwoods folks. They were remarkably cosmopolitan, global citizens very early on. After the colonization of this region.
Connecticut State historian Walt Woodward described the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center as arguably more engaging and informative than the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. That must make you feel good.
We hear that a lot, and we're very happy about that. Certainly, the story that we're telling is very engaging, very comprehensive. It's immersive more than anything, so people can come into the museum and feel like they're walking back in time to the 16th century or 12,000 years ago, as the case might be.
We have a couple minutes left, Jason, and again, when the museum was first created, there wasn't a lot of competition in the casino world, and lot of the funds that the Pequots, Mashantucket Pequots, were able to earn during that time helped build such an expansive museum. What are the challenges moving forward in terms of getting other people interested in supporting this museum?
Well, yeah, the world of museums is always challenged by financial considerations, and we're working through some of that and building partnerships with colleges and universities. Especially right now, UConn and Khan College have been great partners, where we're working collaboratively on some new initiatives around human rights education, social justice initiatives, programs around diversity and inclusion, and really kind of taking this story of indigenous people from this region and not thinking about it just as something of the past. But, we really consider here indigenous futures, and engaging contemporary issues in Indian country is something that's really been overlooked in this nation for far too long. Last year's Standing Rock really brought some of this conversation to a head. We participated in that. And for most of the Indian communities in this nation, every one of them has some type of standing rock, and we want to bring attention to that for the American public and raise the level of awareness and engagement around these issues. So through those kinds of initiatives, we're looking to build funding sources and opportunities to grow our mission and vision for the future of the museum.
I've been speaking with Jason Mancini. He's director of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Coming up, we're going to hear an audio tour of the museum from the natural history of the region to the distinct culture of the Pequot people. Jason, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy.
Coming up, we're going to hear that audio tour, and we hope you stay with us. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You just heard from Jason Mancini. He's director of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Earlier this month, Where We Live got a tour of the more than 300,000 square foot facility in the southeast corner of our state.
Yeah, so this is our typical group entrance here. This
Chris Newell leads us through the expansive museum, where he's head of the education department. He tells us a little about his background. He married a member of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation, but he grew up in Maine as a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe.
Where we are standing currently is we are in one of the main entry places, which is called the gathering space here. The gathering space here is really kind of an opening exhibit, even though it's a big, empty area that we can use for events and other things that we put on here at the museum. It also starts your visiting experience here. So you'll walk in and you're going to see three large dugout canoes. Two of them are replicas with life cast figures in there. All of our figures are life cast from real people, so they're very, very lifelike. And some of them, most of them actually are local folks here, so some of these are friends of mine. And then, of course, the third machine that you see there, that is an authentic dugout canoe that we made here at the museum, a 36-footer named Nukumus, who is actually the longest dugout canoe produced in this area in the last couple of hundred years, made from tulip poplar. So that begins your visiting experience right there. Even as we're just gathering together, we're bringing our school groups into this area, we're coordinating who's going where, who's starting what tour. You know, this begins their experience here, and the architecture of the building also adds to that. So the word Pequot translates to the people of the shallow water, and so the floor here, this large blue floor with the speckling with quahog shells spread all around them, represents a large estuary, which is where the Pequots would live as they seasonally migrated throughout the season. In the summer and late fall, they would be on the ocean shore camping around estuaries, and so this room represents a large estuary. In the top of the room, in the glass ceiling, there is an architectural structure that looks like an overturned machine or an overturned dugout canoe. And then when you guys enter and exit the building, the facade of the building looks like a giant wampum belt. And a wampum being a big part of the tribal history here, those being shell beads made from specific shells we find around Long Island Sound here, the quahog and the channeled whelk found in this area, used amongst the tribes for gifts of significance. But when the Dutch arrive here, they become part of the trading network as well. And that's where we kind of get the idea of wampum as Indian money, but that was never the case amongst the way tribes use it amongst themselves. And it's just the Dutch would use it as an exchange rate because they wanted beaver fur. And so we cover a lot of that in the history as we go downstairs. Once again, when we go down, it's a very immersive experience while you're here. And so you're literally walking into spaces that are full recreations of the time and place, of the exhibit itself.
From the gathering space, Chris leads us into an entrance exhibit where the walls are covered in bark and rocks. These rocks were excavated during construction of the museum back in the late 1990s. Chris says they recycled them for use in both the interior and exterior walls of the museum because they view rocks as the first gifts from the land and the water.
Now, one of the things that we do at this museum that's not common amongst museums is there is a mixture of natural science and ethnohistory here. So the beginning of the tour actually starts with a whole lot of natural science. We will see large animals that existed here 10,000 years ago, what we call megafauna, mastodons, dire wolves, giant beavers, caribou. And then we start to transition forward. And as we do that, we see the change in climate here and people adapting to those changes. And then we see the namesake of the Pequots taking shape as they start fishing and advancements in technology that happen all the way through, usually through trade, and a lot of tribes in this region here traded from all over. In fact, Passamaquoddy people were located in eastern Maine. The word Connecticut in my language translates to something long and straight. That was our place name for the Connecticut River, which if you looked on a map is a pretty straight north-south flow. It's an accurate description of that river. To the tribes in this region, that word Connecticut translates to the long tidal wetland. And so this is the land where the Connecticut empties out. And so we knew this place as Connecticut as well, even all the way up 8-hour drive by car. You can imagine by canoe how long that trip would be, but we did come down here to trade for the wampum that was created by the tribes here, as well as some other things that they had, and we traded our technologies back and forth and we learned from each other. And that's one of the things I always try to get across on my tours, is that Native peoples are not static. We are not stuck in one mode of time. We have always adapted to new technologies as they became available. And so when the Europeans arrived, the Dutch especially, they bring their iron kettles and brass kettles and other metal goods. Just natural that the native people would in this region would take advantage of those new technologies. And we'll be seeing that as we go through the exhibits. So here we are in our entrance exhibit. We have a welcome from Terry Bell, who was actually the first director of the museum when the museum first opened back in 1998. And then, you know, we see some of our major sponsors. That picture of rhododendrons, we kind of walked past it, but there's a little bit of a reason why we put that there. The rhododendrons that grow in the Great Cedar Swamp, which is located directly behind the museum, which has the 12,000-year-old paleo remains in there, that area was known, that swamp was known traditionally to the people as a place of refuge. They would go into that swamp to leave behind their enemies. Very thick undergrowth in there, very hard for people to follow them when they would go in there. And so they would use that space during the time of the Pequot War. And the English, a sachem, a Pequot leader, would take his people into the swamp trying to escape English soldiers as they were following them. They end up being caught and massacred in the swamp. And ever since then, it's said that the color of the rhododendrons now grows pink because of the blood that was spilled there. So it's a little bit of the tribal lore we have going on there. They're white in that picture, which is how they grow just about everywhere else, but in the Great Cedar Swamp we do see pink rhododendrons grow there. So one of the few places you'll actually see that. So this is what, when you enter the exhibits, you begin with this picture of the Mashantucket Pequot community. This was taken in 1998, but still representative of the community of today. And what the lesson I try to get across to folks here is, this idea of what does an Indian look like? You know, some people have a preconceived notion of how Native people look, but, you know, it's more than looks. And so if you look at this picture, we see a lot of various ethnicity mixed in with the tribe of today. That's part of their story why this would happen. But these folks right here, through their history, would steadfastly hold on to their land base here at Mashantucket, this reservation being the oldest continuously occupied reservation in the country, set aside for them in the year 1666. So the reservation system actually starts here in Connecticut, and some of this, a lot of folks in America are not aware of that. We talk about early reservation period happening in the 19th century. That's when westward expansion was going on and the federal government was creating reservations. But before we had a federal government, The colonies were doing it. They started here in Connecticut. These folks would, through some very harsh and unjust times, like the Pequot War, and like the census data the state was doing to try to eliminate their identity as Pequots, they would steadfastly hold on to their land base here, their identity as Pequots, and their self-governance of this land here through some very, very unjust times. And so their story is one of survivance and making it through those very, very difficult times. So these folks right here are the ancestors and some of them themselves that suffered through the time of not being recognized, living under the thumb of the state as wards of the state under first the Parks and Wildlife Department and then the Welfare Department later. And the state had complete control of them. They achieved their federal recognition and they now are striving towards self-sufficiency. And this is actually one of the most self-sufficient tribes in the nation now. They can make a living wage off of their own economy here with the casino. And so the end of the story, when we get to the end of the exhibits, actually ends on a high note. You know, even though we see the massacre and other things that happened throughout their history, we actually see in the modern day times in 2017 a thriving community here with the ability to use monies for education and housing. They are all once again back, allowed back on their ancestral land here, which was, you know, the difficult thing for them to remain to do. The oppression of the state reducing this reservation from 2,500 acres originally down by the 1960s to only 200 acres. Now it's back to about 1,100 acres, but that 200 acre plot was the worst part to live on. Many of them had to make the difficult choice to leave the reservation, many of them ending up in the coastal towns due to the whaling industry, and that's where we saw intermarriage happen for about 100 years. That's why we see the various ethnicity mixed in here. But once again, even though they lived off reservation, they considered themselves as Pequots first. And that's very important because that when they would come back and reassume their land base here, having that identity and being able to prove it was a big part of them achieving federal recognition.
This is Where We Live. Today we're taking you on a tour of the largest Native American History Museum in the U.S. It's right here in Connecticut. The Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center is in the southeast part of our state. Our guide is Chris Newell. He leads the museum's education department. One of the most striking features of this museum are the life-size dioramas. But before a visitor reaches those exhibits, the museum focuses on the natural history of the region. Visitors are led back to the Ice Age via escalator down into a turquoise room designed to mimic glacial melt and where water cascades down the walls.
So the walls are, replicas. They look like a large glacial wall. And they're really well done. You know, the dirt that would be in the ice and everything else that's located in there, we see some of the rocks frozen in the ice, and then we hear water rushing. So as the glacier is melting, of course, it's going to cause water to rush down and drip off of the ice cave, and we have certain sections where you see water dripping down. So it's really an immersive experience for kids especially, but for all people. I mean, everybody kind of gets a thrill out of this riding this escalator, you know, so it's kind of one of the highlights of the journey as you go through here. So we get here, and this is where this globe right here shows the movement of ice over time. There are three different color dots that you see represented on there. The white dots representing ice as the glacier grows. The green dots, what that is as the glacier grew, the sea level dropped. And so that would become dried land on the continental shelf as the sea level would drop below that. So that's where we see the green dots showing up. And then the blue dots we just saw as the glacier is retreating, it's leaving behind some glacial formations like famous ones like the Great Lakes and Hudson's Bay. And so that's what we see going on here. So this is a good way to, visually represent for, especially those that haven't had this natural science before, how the ice would have moved, how much it covered, at what time period. Really gives them a good idea, you know, but we're at this point, we're only talking natural history here. We're going to transition in a little bit, but we also include a set of pictures here on the wall. These are all on the reservation here. These are just more evidence of the glacial rock formations that were left behind. Council rocks there, a big flat rock that makes a natural meeting space in the woods that's located here. Balancing rock on the bottom, that big boulder there dropped in that precarious position. It's actually hanging over the edge of a precipice. You can't tell by the picture, but the story with that is if that rock were to ever fall, it's a sign of bad luck for the community.
community. So it shows that they give spiritual significance even to the stones. And then, of course, the first picture there, that's, you know, the rocks that we see all through the soil here. That's how colonists would find this land, which would drive them a bit nuts, you know, because they wanted to convert it all to farmland. So they had to remove those rocks. And so what did they do with them? They created all of the rock wall boundary walls that we see all throughout Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire and Vermont. That's what they were doing, is literally had to do something with the rocks to create farmland, and so they created boundary walls with them. So if you're wondering, anybody wonders why we have those all through the woods in Connecticut, they seem to go nowhere. At one time, Connecticut, for the most part, was pretty much all clear cut and turned into farmland by colonists. And we only have new growth forest here. And so they would do a lot of change to the land. And one of the things they left behind was those boundary rock walls that we have all over our woods. So we transition now to another gallery. At this point, we're talking about ice, you know, so we can't live on top of the ice. So this is where we talk about the arrival of people. And what we've done, this is a native museum here. We've actually stepped away from science in this gallery. And what we do is we use art to represent creation stories. And so we have 9 different creation stories represented here from tribes all across the U.S., Canada, different regions. And so what you do, these art pieces commissioned to help tell the story. So these were commissioned specifically for the stories that they're telling here. And, you know, I always tell people, take the time, read the placards. What you find is there are some commonalities going on here. Every story is very different, but some of the things that are common are the idea that the land is not an object that you can possess, but it's something that sustains you. So that's a concept that's very different from European colonists' ideas of land usage, where they do own land. Native cultures here in this region, they did not own land. They owned possessions. They did have that concept, but the land itself was considered like a living being, and so you could not own it. It sustains you instead. So that's what we see going on here, is creation stories. We use creation stories because it doesn't matter where in the world you come from, your culture has a story of creation.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're learning about the history of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation through their museum in the southeast part of Connecticut. Chris Newell is our guide. He's head of the museum's education department. After the break, we'll continue our tour where we take you to one of the museum's most impressive exhibits, a half-acre replica of a Pequot village in the 16th century. And later, we'll learn what happens to the Pequots with the arrival of the Europeans and how the Pequot War dramatically shaped the tribe's future. This is Where We Live. Today we're on a tour of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center in southeast Connecticut. Chris Newell is our tour guide. He's head of education at the museum. Our next stop is one of the most memorable exhibits here. It's a replica of a Pequot village.
So you walk into this village, and for little kids, it's often a wow moment as they walk in here, because you don't see exhibits this large and this detailed in many places. And so for a lot of kids, this is the first time they see something this big and this detailed. And what you're seeing here is essentially a summer village day and the regular happenings of a summer village day. The setting is a hot August day in here. All of the life casts that you see here, once again, cast from real people. Everybody's dressed for the summer weather. And so when we have very, very young kids, we have to remind them that, you know, we only had buckskin to make clothing out of. And so everybody's dressed from the waist down only. But that's an accurate depiction of how people looked here at this time period. We see what are called weetus, and most popularly known as wigwams. But in the local lingo here, they call their homes weetus instead. But essentially, they are the same type of structure. They're a bark-covered dome-shaped home in this region, using thick barks like oak barks or tulip poplar. We see just regular everyday village life. We see a young girl right here at the beginning
throwing out the refuse, the trash, onto the refuse pile, the midden, and archaeologists know what that is. Middens are the refuse pile left behind by native peoples, these large shell heaps. You can learn just tons of information by digging through these shell heaps about the people, how they lived, what they ate, and what they were doing here. We also see new technologies as we walk into here. So we have a garden. Advancement of horticulture doesn't arrive here until about 1,000 years ago. So that's something we haven't seen that shows up here in the village exhibit. And what they're growing are corn, beans, and squash, known culturally as the Three Sisters, growing in a style of farming called complementary farming, where they're planted in bunches together, and they affect each other and help each other to grow when you plant them in that way. And this is a style of farming practiced by tribes all the way out as far as Arizona. So this is something that would make its way and migrate itself up here to the northeast from the southwest. And this is where actually a piece of their mythology, their history from the spiritual sense, matches up with the science, because the story of how they got corn, beans, and squash were that they were given by their southwest deity named Catantuit to the crow. And the crow brought them here to the people in the northeast. And the advent of corn in this region actually does come from the southwest. And so it does actually match up with their traditional stories here. So we walk through the village, and once again, you see the various numbers throughout the floor here. We have various scenes going on here. This is the preparation of a meal, new technology showing up. And because of the advancement of horticulture, a lot of their food preparation is not the preparation or drying of meats at this point. It is vegetable processing here, corn, beans, and squash, and mostly corn. Corn is a Native American crop, by the way. It doesn't just come in yellow. I always try to get that across to the young ones. It comes in all colors, you know. And the stuff we call Indian corn, you know, really all corn is Indian corn. That's my little message for the young ones. It was a crop invented by Native peoples all the way in the southwest. It eventually migrates up here to the northeast. So all corn is really Indian corn. Doesn't matter what color it is. And corn, beans, and squash, by the way, if you eat those three vegetables, they will sustain you. It meets all your nutritional needs. And so it was a very smart thing for Native people to grow corn, beans, and squash, because even without fish, without meat, or anything else, they could sustain themselves off of the vegetables alone if necessary. But this area of southeast New England has fishing, it has good hunting, it has a little bit of everything, and so they actually had a ton of good nutrition here, and the village people look very tall. I get asked about that all the time. That's on purpose. Once again, we know that Pequots were written in history for their size and stature, and really that's due to the tremendous nutrition and natural resources available to them in this region of Connecticut. So we see an estuary right here. So this is a live example of an estuary rather than the symbolic one we saw in the gathering space. So we see fresh water coming from the waterfall, flowing down the brook, mixing into the estuary, and then the salt marsh in the background there. And so this is where we tell people this is a mixture of fresh and salt water called brackish water, a large shallow pool. We see some young men out there, young men having to do with the fishing, hunting, and foreign relations typically. So men are typically in control of what's outside the village, women more in control of what's happening inside the village. The young men here, they are fishing for the tatog, the blackfish, harpooning them, tossing them up on shore to that young lady who's cleaning and gutting them with a stone knife at this point. That's going to change pretty soon when the Dutch arrive, and smoking the fish on that platform. We see a large number of bark-covered weetoos. Those are actually the winter covering. So even though we tell people it is a hot summer day, the bark covering is actually the winter covering. But we do see in the backside here of the village a cattail reed-covered weetoo, which would be the summer covering. And the reason for using reeds, tribes all up and down the coast do this. It's a lot cooler during the summer months. The air can pass through gently. And on a rainy day, all of those reeds absorb water. They swell up, and they become waterproof on a rainy day. So reed technology during the summer months was used by coastal tribes all the way up and down the Atlantic coast and even on the west coast in this region, typically using cattails. And cattails are even before you make them into the mats, if you cut them fresh, they are edible. So that becomes a food source as well.
the leadership of the village we talked to here. We just walked past the Sachem's Weetoo, and that's one of the Weetoos that we open up to the public. They can walk inside there and see what an inside of a Weetoo would look like. There are also three side galleries we're not spending much time in as well. Side galleries built onto the side of this one large room here, talking about Pequot Village daily life, a little bit on the language and some of the spirituality. And then we see the last side gallery being the arrival of Europeans, because we're about to walk under this large log, this broken tree, and this represents a break in time. So now we change the time from 1550s to the 1600s, and we're talking about the arrival of the Dutch here. And we see a big change to the village, the advent of the palisade wall being built for protection or fortification. Largely, this doesn't happen until Europeans arrive. A couple of reasons. Number one, the Dutch were new, so they were a little scared of each other. Dutch settlements also had high walls, but the Dutch brought with them trade goods, iron kettles, brass kettles, steel tools, trade cloth, beads. These were very valuable to the Pequots, and they set up a good trading network with the Dutch. And what happens is other tribes become jealous of the relationship with the Dutch, and they become contentious and hostile during this time where they were previously pretty good friends. So the protection is not just from the arriving Dutch, but also contentious and hostile tribes who are all competing with each other for the ability to trade with the different European groups that are arriving here, because it's not just the Dutch that arrive here. A little later, we're going to have the English arrive here. And when that happens, we now have all the ingredients that create the soup we call the Pequot War.
This is Where We Live, on a tour of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. Our tour guide, Chris Newell, leads us from the lifelike Pequot village into a hallway where a group of school children excitedly play a Native American game of ring and pin. We stop outside one of the museum's theaters where a movie plays detailing the Pequot War.
All right, so this red hallway is red for a reason. This is where we get into talking about the Pequot War. Now, the Pequot War occurred from 1636 to 1638 between the Pequots and the English settlers. So what happened essentially is the Dutch were here for 30 years. They did make good friends with the Pequots. They were making good money with the wampum beaver fur trade. And what happens is the Mayflower then arrives in Plymouth in 1620, right? Gloucester gets established by the English in 1626. And then by the 1630s, they're in Rhode Island, and now in southeast Connecticut. And what happens is the Pequots, being the largest political and military force, allow the English to set up a couple settlements on the Connecticut River at their permission, and they start to trade with both the Dutch and the English. But unfortunately for the Dutch, this means they are now splitting the profits between them and the English. This actually angers the Dutch in their relationship, and it sours. And there is some small skirmishing fighting that's going on because the Pequots are, in the Dutch point of view, not living up to their trade agreement and only exclusively trading with the Dutch. And so since they're losing money, they're upset. But the war was between the Pequots and the English. But really, the beginning of the war starts with an action of a Dutchman. A Dutch tradesman captures a Pequot sachem, ransoms him for 50,000 wampum beads during the souring of the relationship that was happening. And the tribe pays the ransom, but they were betrayed when they were returned a dead body, which angers the Pequots against the Dutch, but really against Europeans in general. However, trade still so valuable that they're trying to keep it going. And so later on, the son of that sachem that was killed is making another trade deal with an Englishman, a man named John Stone. John Stone did not have the best reputation. He was trying to cheat the Pequots, and he gets figured out, and they fight in the cabin, and in the process, John Stone gets killed. Now an Englishman has died in Pequot territory, and the English decide they're going to enforce their own law in Pequot territory. And remember, at this point, they're existing here at the permission of the Pequots. So their attempt to do this was really an act of aggression. And they would demand the heads. They would come with several ships at the village where John Stone was killed, demanding the heads of those killed, those involved with the killing of their countrymen. And the Pequots basically tell them, you wait here, We'll go talk about it, and we'll come back with our decision. But the English don't trust that they're going to come back with the decision they want, and so they attack the village. And several villagers get killed, several women get captured, and now the relationship between the Pequots and English really starts to become hostile so fast that eventually the English leadership in Hartford would declare offensive war on the Pequots. Now, why? There's a couple of reasons. The Dutch, once again, were here for money. Okay, so they weren't here to live permanently. The English, very, very different story, right? The Mayflower, those folks were coming to live here permanently. So they wanted to make their settlements prosperous. And so one of the ways to do that was to take over the beaver for wampum trade, who the Pequots were basically in control of and the English were contentious and hostile with. So if you eliminate the land of Pequots, you can now work with other wampum-producing tribes who are friendly to you, like Narragansetts, who they did make a good friendship with. So they do declare war on the Pequots in 1636 with the aim of eliminating the land of Pequots. This was an attempt at a genocide. This is the first time a European power takes on a native power here in the Americas. And the first year of the war, actually, the English don't win a battle. They're technologically superior, but tactically very much inferior. They're used to open field battle tactics where, you know, that occur in Europe, where native people don't fight that way here. And tactically, they were doing things like drawing soldiers out of forts into traps in the woods, where they were popping down out of the trees, jumping up out of the leaves, and they're getting the soldiers that way, which the English felt was kind of unfair. But that's the way native people fought here, so they would have to adjust. So the turning point of the war happens right about the midpoint in May of 1637. The English would ally themselves with Narragansetts, Mohegans, and some other tribes in the region here against the Pequots. And in the early morning hours of late May 1637, they would sneak attack a fort in Mystic, Connecticut, and light it on fire, and in the process kill 600 men, women, and children, known as the Pequot Massacre in history. This was the first win for the English in the war. This was the turning point of the war. With their allies, they would continue to win through the next year and then eventually subjugate the Pequots as slaves. So at the end of the war, the Pequots lose their territory to the English by conquest, which is about 250 square miles, and the English draw up a document. The document was called the Treaty of Hartford. Now, this is an English document, okay? It's written in the English language, so it has the values of England in it, which includes the values of land ownership. A lot of the provisions were basically about what they're going to do with the land that they had just conquered from the Pequots, and they even exclude their allies, Narragansetts and Mohegans, from coming onto the land. They're not allowed to do so. And they also create a new relationship. They basically say that if Mohegans and Narragansetts, if you guys start to fight with each other, we, the English, are going to come in and settle the fight for you at threat of war. And so this is the dynamic that now gets set up. The English, existing previously by permission, now are taking over the power in this region here from even their allies. And the surviving Pequots are subjugated as slaves. And so that's why we have two Pequot nations of today. Those subjugated as slaves under the Mohegans would eventually become the Mashantucket Pequots. Those subjugated under Miantonomi and the Narragansett would become the Eastern or Pawcatuck Pequots. So the war causes the split. But really, both Pequot tribes are just Pequot, and that's their original standing here. And, you know, in modern-day America here, we have one of them federally recognized and one only state recognized. It is not fair that that situation occurs. They are both descend from the exact same stock of people. Both tribes should be federally recognized.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs back in 2002 granted the Eastern Pequots federal recognition, but they lost the status 3 years later after the state of Connecticut and three towns appealed the Bureau's decision. Now, the Eastern Pequots to this day are still trying to regain that recognition.
Pequots were still Pequots. It didn't matter if they lived here or not. So many of them moved off reservation to find jobs and work. And because of the whaling industry, a lot of them ended up in coastal towns in this region here. So this is a map of Westerly and Pawcatuck, which is just down the road from here. These red dots lots represent Native-owned or Native-rented homes. And if you look, they're all consolidated together into Native neighborhoods. In fact, this area was called the Westerly Indian Neighborhood. And it just so happens that this Westerly Indian Neighborhood coincides with the Black and Italian neighborhood that surrounds it. So naturally, 100 years of them living this way, they did intermarry. And so if we think back to that first picture, the various ethnicities mixed in with the tribe of today, this part of their history is where that would occur. But these folks, even though they're living off reservation, even though they're intermarrying, never gave up their identity as Pequots. It's just to the state. The state said, you don't live on the reservation, you don't count. So what happens is, it gets so dire here, by 1900, there's only 11 families left. By the 1960s, it's only two women left on the reservation. And they were told by the state, if you die or leave this land, we're going to take your last 200 acres and turn it into a state park. They would have lost their nationhood altogether had that happened. So those two women saw the writing on the wall. What they started to do was hand out governmental responsibilities to their relatives who self-identify as Pequots in these off-reservation areas to draw them back to the land here and start counting higher numbers back here on the reservation. That mantle was taken up by one of their grandsons. Elizabeth George's grandson is named Skip Hayward. He's elected chief in the 70s. He would start economic opportunity here on the reservation, very small scale at first, and they weren't all successful. So maple syrup business, a hydroponic lettuce facility, a vegetable garden, a small restaurant called Mr. Pizza, and they also raised hogs. So this didn't allow for people to make a huge amount of money if they were going to come back here. And really, 70s housing is pretty evident. That trailer that we see over there at the end of the exhibits here, that's what 70s housing looked like on the reservation. No shower in there. You had to use the hose in the back. So if you're going to come back here, you're coming back to live under those conditions. And you're going to be under the thumb of the state. So Skip, at the time, saw the value in getting the tribe federally recognized. Now, that means you have to prove to the federal government you have existed with a government, a land base, all the way from the time the United States government began in the 1700s all the way up to the present, continuously without a break. That's a difficult thing to prove. Some tribes have been trying for 20 years to go through the process to get approved. However, the census data that was taken against and used against the Pequot tribe all those years actually became valuable evidence in proving their existence here over time continually. And eventually they would call somebody on a census Pequot or Indian. And so they did have official records that show people on the reservation self-governing this place. And they win federal recognition, not through the BIA process, but through a federal law called the Connecticut Indian Land Claim Settlement Act in 1983. Now, the land claim had to do with that sale of land in 1855, which was illegal. The first Congress created a law called the Federal Trade and Intercourse Act, which said that Indian land could not be sold without the approval of the federal government. That was done by the state alone in 1855, so it was illegal. Skip sues the landowners, the disputed land, not with the idea of forcing them off the land, but with the idea of righting the historic wrong. So part of the settlement included a payment of $900,000 for the loss of land, which they were then able to use to rebuy land. And so the end of the story actually ends on a high note here. The reservation was increased from 200 acres up to about 1,100 acres from willing landowners. They never forced anybody to sell. They gained federal recognition. They have money for housing and education and laws that have to do with federally recognized tribes like the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act apply here on the reservation. And so the Pequots in 1992 open up Foxwoods Casino. At the time, no competition for it. Grows to become the world's largest resort casino for a while. And now it's the largest in the Western Hemisphere, I believe, but still, you know, one of the top leaders in the industry. And so now the tribe can come back and live on their land and make a living wage off their own economy. They are one of the most self-sufficient tribes in this nation right now because they are not so dependent on federal money for survival as they are dependent upon their own economy that they created themselves here. So the end of the story does end on a high note. The land is now repopulated by Pequots. We have close to 1,000 of them living on or near the reservation. And it gives us also this great big giant museum to work in here, which is, you know, the place I love to be because I love this work. I love teaching Native history, and I get to use this awesome facility here. And so the casino is also part of the creation of this place as well, which is really a treasure for the state of Connecticut and really for this country because of the history that's told here and how well we were able to tell it.
That's Chris Newell, head of education at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center in southeastern Connecticut. For photos of our visit, check out WMPR.org/where we live. Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Thanks to the staff of the Mashantucket Pequot Museum for our extensive tour. Also thanks to producer Carmen Baskoff. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.